You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the podcast network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast for Wednesday, September 30th, 2009. This is episode 99, Books in the Cloud. It's time again for the Wells Tech Podcast. We've gathered again around our digital conference room table, as usual, to talk about topics of technology, but not just technology, but where they intersect with ministry. And joining me, as usual, on the other side of the digital table is Sally Draper from Sleepy Eye, Minnesota. Good morning, Sally.
Hi, Martin. How are you this morning?
I'm well. How are you?
I am great, enjoying the cool fall weather. I think the winds have finally died down, and we're seeing a little bit of a sunshine today, so all is good in Sleepy Eye.
Oh, they're howling over here yet. 50-mile-per-hour gusts last night, I heard, so that was pretty good. And also joining us as our semi-regular classroom technology correspondent from New London, Wisconsin, Gail Potratz. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning.
How are you?
Happy to be here. Happy to be here today. I'm great.
Good. And we've got lots that we could talk about, and we never have a shortage of topics when Gail comes on because our focus on these shows is classroom technology, and we're going to talk about books. And books get a lot of attention these days, not the traditional paper-bound books, but digital books. We hear a lot about the Kindle. We hear about the new Sony readers. There's probably a couple other brands I'm forgetting now. Everybody's got a digital book now, and there's the EPUB format. There's Amazon's format. There's all kinds of competition there. But we're going to take it up just a notch and talk about just the digitizing of books, and as usual, Google's right in the center of it, right, Sally?
That's right, Martin. Google, our favorite website. It seems to be everywhere. And actually, I had the opportunity a week or so ago to sit in on a webinar run by Google, presented to the United States Distance Learning Association. And one of their policy analysts from Google, Derek Slater, ran the webinar with a specific focus on Google Books, their product to digitize all of the written content and books in the world. And the way that he started the webinar was with Google's mission statement, which is basically to organize the world's information and make it accessible and usable. And, you know, that applies not just to online content, which is what we're used to using Google for, but also to offline content. So Google has a vision of making all the offline content accessible. And obviously, there's way more content offline even than there is online. So, you know, being able to turn all of the books sitting on all the shelves of all the libraries in the world into a digitized format is what Google Books is all about.
So what's in this for Google? They're a for-profit enterprise. They're not totally philanthropist. What are they after here?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that's what a lot of people are asking. But I think the main thing is that if they have some control over this content, they can potentially sell you the content in some format, and that's where the controversy or the rub comes in. You know, who's going to get the money if these books get sold? Basically.
So, what kind of numbers? You know, what kind of numbers are we talking about?
I guess currently they have 10 million books digitized, and that's just scratching the surface. I want to say that he said about 75% of the books that are in copyright currently are out of print. So there's this huge content area of books that are out of print that they haven't even begun to scratch the surface of. 10 million digitized, 2 million of those are in public domain, so you can get those books and read them, you know, freely without any kind of copyright issues whatsoever. 2 million of them, they've partnered with publishers. They have agreements to be able to display up to 20% of the book online and then provide you with links to purchase the book. And what that means is if you're doing research and say you're researching George Washington or some topic, you're going to be able to read a few pages of the book where that topic comes up if they have this partnership, this 20% agreement with the publisher.
So is it is it any 20%, the 20% that you happen to be searching on, or the 20% they determine?
It's my understanding that it's any. It's like thumbing through a book at the bookstore and you would zero in on the part that you're interested in.
Okay.
So that's what I understood from it. I could be wrong on that. So, but I'm pretty sure that's correct.
Well, if that's true, that's a great boon for research.
Absolutely. And, you know, the fact that it's Google means that you're not only getting the content, that 20% display of it, but you're getting links to where you can purchase it online. And another feature of Google Books, which I was quite impressed with, is a link to where you can get it from the library. Mm-hmm. And based on your IP address, they know your general location. They suggest libraries in your area when you go to that link. So that's really impressive. Another thing that they do is provide Google Maps of any of the locations mentioned in the books that you're searching. So you can have like a visual representation of locations that are part of the books you're searching. So kind of bringing together some interesting tools from them.
Yeah, it's another evidence of the semantic web, just making sure that the information that we have from all different corners is brought together in a usable, relevant fashion. Gail, from your perspective as an educator and in the classroom, does this make a difference?
Well, I think it could have a lot of potential power. What I did is to try it out. I used some literature in the upper grades that I sometimes have trouble finding books because they're not available. And some literature is out of print. And what I did is I didn't do an exhaustive search, but I looked to see if I could get a whole text copy of certain pieces. And of course, I couldn't do that at this time.
Uh-huh.
But theoretically, as this moves along, that's what I'd be able to do. I'd be able to see the whole copy of the book there, if I understand correctly.
So in the academic world, are we moving away from the paper textbook into the digital world, essentially?
I'm speaking mostly as an elementary school teacher here, a middle school teacher, and that doesn't occur as much as moving away from pencil and paper and writing digitally.
Sure.
I think we still do the bulk of our reading on paper.
Uh-huh.
Unless we're working in a blog and, you know, responding to blogs and that kind of thing, and you're reading that material. But as far as the literature itself and whatnot, it is usually on paper. The teachers, though, however, may be doing more reading online. Mm-hmm. I do more reading online as I'm searching for material and books that I would use with the kids, and that's where something like this could be handy. I took the book we're currently reading, Light in the Forest, and I looked for that, and I looked to see what chapters were in there for, you know, and I did a search and played around with that a little bit. And yeah, I think it does have great potential for searching for things you might be looking for in a particular piece of literature.
Or research projects, those kinds of things, right?
Right.
I was just talking with a teacher here in our school, and she's a DMLC graduate from probably about 25 to 30 years ago. And she told me the story of doing a big research project for class at DMLC, and how she had to ride away to the libraries in the Twin Cities to have them mail her books. You know, it was just this huge deal to be able to get books, and it took a written letter to them, you know, to request that. And obviously, you know, we have interlibrary loan now and all of that kind of functionality. I think this just notches it up, and I think research, Martin, is the big area in education where we're going to see just a huge impact with this kind of product.
Yeah, and especially for something like that, where she probably didn't need the entire book. She just needed probably a piece of a chapter for a research project. And the fact that it could be online, digitized, easily cut and pasted and then referenced in whatever she's doing. You know, as I think about digital works and where they're probably the most popular now is probably in higher ed. And I suppose that works the same, and I think that's going to work the same in one laptop per child kinds of scenarios, where that is going to be more prevalent in higher ed and then trickle down over time to maybe situations like elementary schools.
Right. I see this as a very positive thing for higher education, even way up to graduate level mm-hmm. work. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, the research. 10 years ago, working on my degree, there was nothing like this. And searching through the educational journals and that type of thing, to have a system like this to look at that material and find exactly what you're looking for would have been very beneficial.
Sally, go ahead, Sally.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I'm thinking that microfiche training that I got at the library as a kid is not an issue anymore for our kids.
Yeah, no kidding.
Microfiche machine.
So, that's Sally, right. Did you get a sense for the kinds of content that is going to be digitized? Is it just literary works, or are these reference works, or even textbooks? You know, what are we talking about here? Or is it everything?
Well,
anything with an ISBN number.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much everything. Google has partnered with 42 libraries around the world. And they mentioned the University of Michigan, Stanford, University of Texas at Austin, Oxford, and I think they mentioned one in Japan. So these worldwide academic centers, basically, that mm-hmm. they've partnered with. And that's where the scanning is actually taking place. They're literally emptying their shelves and scanning everything that they have available. The big deal is that there's this pending settlement on a class action lawsuit,
right.
And books that are even in copyright could potentially be displayed at least at 20% view of them.
Wow.
Even if they're in copyright, because so many of these books are out of print and inaccessible unless you can actually walk into the University of Michigan library and pull it off the shelf physically. Mm-hmm. So now making them accessible this way, and Google even has some custom machines that they're building that would allow you to print a book, on the spot. I think they're like $100,000 for these machines, but potentially being able to print again an out-of-print book. Just a lot of power in that.
Did you get a chance to search around for any religious works, let's say Luther's works or something like that?
That's a good question, Martin, and I bet we can include some links like that in the show notes.
Okay.
But I haven't done enough research yet to have an answer for that.
Very good. I think part of the controversy is also who will eventually own the copyright on some of these orphaned works and these things that are no longer in under copyright. Does Google then own that, or can anybody basically do whatever they want with that?
Yeah, and I guess that's a good question that the Google representative didn't get real deep into that. They're really trying to gather steam behind the fact that it's a good thing to digitize all this content, to make it searchable. They just want to point you to where you can purchase it or view it online. They're going to offer subscriptions for schools to be able to get a full view at mm-hmm. some of these public book domain books, like the public domain books, but some of these out of print books that are still under copyright. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to offer public library access so that
right.
One terminal per library would have complete access to all the books. So lots of nuances to it. I don't know that they've really addressed, or maybe that's still what's being decided with this lawsuit, who will actually own the copyright.
Sure.
Or if, if copyright's an issue, if it's able to be tied back to the publisher, then maybe that's where it ultimately goes.
Mm-hmm. That's probably going to create a nice dilemma, not a nice dilemma, but a dilemma for the public library system, wouldn't you think? If everything is digitized, I think the shelves and shelves of books that we now fill or line our public libraries is, it may change the landscape for that. In fact, I think I heard recently that the country's oldest public library is going to be closing this year.
Oh, wow. Have you experienced the e-book reader at all? Either of you?
I've just done it in the store. I have
just
put my hands on it and did the Sony one, and I've played with the Kindle a little bit, but not enough to to have any kind of judgment on whether it's, you know, usable for, you know, sitting in bed with. How about you, Gail?
I do the Kindle app on my iPod Touch. I read my first book on that this summer. And, Martin, the book that I read was 200 Pomegranates and an Audience of One.
Ah, okay. Which, great book.
Which I actually got from your Goodreads page. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I really liked it. I thought maybe people say, isn't it too small? Don't you find that a problem? I did not find that to be a problem, but I loved it because I could throw it in my purse and did a lot of waiting around at doctor's offices this summer with my husband going through some surgeries. And so you always could just take it out. It was right there and turn it. I thought maybe I'd get like Nintendo thumb from turning pages, but but that didn't happen either. I was very happy with it. I'm looking forward to using it for more.
So, you know, it's a trade-off. My husband actually has the Sony reader. He's had it for a couple of years, and he just finished War and Peace on a Sony reader.
Holy cow.
I'm thinking that, you know, he paged through a lot of pages to do War and Peace, but he totally read it on the Sony reader. So, I mean, for me, I think I'm more like what Gail said earlier. I like to hold a book in my hand, so I'm not quite sure I'd ever get to that. I don't have the patience, even on my little iPod touch screen, to read much more than little short articles and things. So I don't know. I think there's always going to be the market and the need for libraries and books to hold in our hands.
Time will tell, right?
Yeah.
Time will tell. Let's move on to a section that we've recently introduced called Ministry Resources. And the resource that I want to let everybody know about is something that I've been enjoying for probably 6 to 12 months now. And that's a Flickr group. You maybe not aware of it, but on Flickr you can not only post your own photos, but you can collect them into groups and have kind of discussion boards around images. And what church, there's a group called the Church Marketing Labs. They have a Church Marketing Labs Flickr group. And in essence, it's filled with images put up there by church communicators who are building different kinds of imagery for different kinds of programs. So they post logos, images for sermon or service themes, Bible study themes, brochures, and the reason they do it is not only just to share their work, but to get feedback. The reason that I like it is it's just a wealth of ministry ideas, from program to sermon or to service theme ideas to imagery. I mean, a picture is worth 1,000 words, and this group pool, as they call it, has over 6,000 items in it. So just thumbing through all of the images that have been uploaded to this space creates all kinds of possibilities, I would think, for a congregation or a school looking to enhance or promote some of their events. I'm just looking at the homepage right now, and there's something called Fall Family Fiesta, a nicely done graphic that is probably, and each of them probably, each of them has a description of what it's for as well. So I think this is could be a potentially great ministry tool for any congregation looking to jazz up or promote any of their functions. And if you do any of this design work yourself, probably a good way to get feedback on ways to improve it. There's a lot of solid professionals, I get the sense, on this in this group. And you can join. There's 3,600 members in the group right now, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes. But it's flickr.com/groups/CFCC. So lots of potential here. I really enjoy looking at it. I subscribe to the RSS feed, so in my RSS reader I get all the new images that come through, and very, very creative people.
Yeah, I'm checking it out for the first time, Martin, and I'm just feeling very inept in my image editing, image development capabilities. This could
very,
really give
you
a lot of
people.
Ideas.
Yep, and even if you don't, you know, even if you don't think that you need to create some of the fancy images that they're doing, just some good ideas for different events that a congregation could hold, or different service themes that could be used, different brochure concepts, all kinds of good stuff here.
Very good.
All right, let's move on to our picks of the week. Gail, you're our semi-regular guest, so why don't you lead us off?
Okay. Before I actually mention the pick of the week, I wanted to follow up on the discussion yet with Google Books and just add another thing, another idea about books and, sure. and education, and that was, I mentioned Goodreads. I think, Martin, that was one of your picks long, long ago.
Right.
And I've been using that a lot, and it's a way for people to share what they've read and to comment with their friends and recommend books and such. And for a long time, I've been looking for something like that that you could use in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So I was searching for a Web 2.0 tool for quite extensively, and had other people looking for me, had my Twitter group looking, and came up empty until finally I went back actually to Goodreads itself. And mm-hmm. here in the regular Goodreads, there is a feature where you can create groups.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And all I did was create a group, and you have quite a bit of security and privacy as much as you desire for your groups, you know. Mm-hmm. So I just created a group for Emmanuel Lutheran School and friends who love to read, and I'm intending to get yeah. that going in our school,
oh,
first
awesome.
Of all, and then branch out. So I just wanted to let Alexis and those other people know, too, that we're looking at this type of thing and looking for it, that this seems to be the best way to do that.
Very good. So that was pick 1A.
Yeah. Actually, that was my follow-up on Google Books.
Okay.
Now for my pick.
Okay. That's how we're playing it. All right.
Yeah, that's how it goes. Okay. My pick of the week is, in keeping with Google, I tried to keep with the theme here, and I chose Google Side Wiki. And the reason I chose that is because it's relatively new. And this
just last week, right?
Yeah, this pick isn't really so much as it turned out to be as a recommendation maybe, but more of just to make you aware of and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It goes along with the power to the people from Google idea, which I like that. I like that their goal is to make everything universally accessible. I mean, that I can't find fault with that. But I don't know about how useful this will be in the long run. The more I investigate it, you're going to see a lot of it out there, though, so I thought it might be good to talk about it. In order to use Google Side Wiki, you first have to download the most current version of the Google Toolbar. Mm-hmm. And I believe you can use it on Internet Explorer or Firefox. Those, I think, are the two.
Right.
All right. So, and there's some nice features in that toolbar besides this, but you do need that toolbar. And once you have the toolbar, you have a little icon up there so that when you're on any website on the web, and if you want to make a comment on that website, you just click on the tool, and your comments are going to, after you type them in, they're going to appear on a yellow background sidebar to the left of your main frame of your screen. So you can see not only your comments, but everyone else's comments as well. Now, my original thought was, wow, this is going to be great, because very often in school you have kids researching similar topics and they share websites, and there's good ways to do that, but I thought this might work for that, as they're sitting and doing their work, and if they make a comment on the website, on the Side Wiki, and say, this is a great source for whatever, mm-hmm. you know, and make a comment about it, then the other kids, as they come across that website and look at the comments, would see that. Well, they could, but what I found out was the comments are rated, so the way they appear in the column aren't chronological. The way they sequence them is whoever the rater is looks at the comments and rates them according to what they think is...
Well, you can rate each other. So I can look at a comment of yours and say thumbs up or thumbs down as well.
So, but isn't there isn't any rating beyond that going on?
Nope. Well, no. I don't know if Google does any, but I think that was Google's attempt to kind of keep out the riffraff, so to speak,
okay.
So that all of the garbage that sometimes populates these kinds of tools
right.
doesn't float to the top. But I found right. no way to sort them either. So
right, to sort them, to make them valuable, you know, useful to you. The person in the classroom, for example, their comment might be, you know, 50 comments down the line or whatever.
Right.
And
right.
so by the time you're searching and looking for their comment, you're wasting more time. You might as well be using Digo or some other source mm-hmm. to do the same job.
Right.
So
And it's really the, it's really the world commenting on your website.
Right. And people could also put their own links in there to other websites and say, hey, why don't you go here? If you like this, go here.
I see all kinds of abuse.
Yeah, who knows what you're going to get when you go there. So, you as the mod, if you're not the moderator, so you can't delete any of these comments, you know, or
yeah, you have no control. You have no control over what appears next, let's say, to your website or your blog or whatever
right.
it is,
right? Right.
Now,
so
there is a button that says report abuse.
Right.
So if it was abusive, you could.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But then that gets to be just like on Twitter. What's abusive? Who's being the judge there? You know,
right.
sometimes you see things that we certainly consider abusive or don't want the kids in the classroom to see, but yet somebody else would say, well, we didn't really think this was so bad, so we're not going to remove
sure.
it.
Sure. Well, this is in beta, so I have hopes that Google will recognize some of these shortcomings and maybe make it a little bit more useful tool. So
right.
probably
so
probably a good pick, but probably worth keeping our
right.
eyes on.
Yeah. Right. Be aware of it and watch and see what happens. It could turn out to – it has a lot of potential.
Yep,
let's
agree.
Let's say it that way.
I totally agree. Sally.
My turn.
Your
and
turn.
I have an education-oriented pick. It's called Ideas to Inspire at ideastoinspire.co.uk. It's a site done in England, and it is geared toward displaying of Google Docs presentations. So basically there's a whole series of embedded presentations on this website organized for educators, particularly those who are using Web 2.0 type tools, educational technology type tools in their curriculum. So there are several different tabs across the top, curriculum ideas, interesting ways to use ICT hardware in the classroom, interesting ways to use ICT software and online tools, and then other collaborative presentations. So first thing I had to do was figure out what ICT was, which apparently in Great Britain is a term that they use a lot, but it's not one that I was familiar with. It stands for Information and Communication Technologies. So basically, education technology in the classroom, and they use that acronym ICT to represent that. So under curriculum ideas, you're going to find ideas for writing, math, science, art, music, all those different kind of things represented there, and many of them tying to either Web 2.0 tools or smart board applications or that kind of thing. Under hardware, that's where you get into the interactive whiteboards or smart boards, ways to use the GPS in the classroom, netbooks, pocket video cameras, and that kind of thing in the classroom. And if you click on any of these categories, then like I said, you're going to get this presentation basically that has a slideshow of ideas for you to use, you know, with your interactive whiteboard, for instance. In the software category, they have things like Google Earth, Wordle, VoiceThread, using search engines, just lots of the different Web 2.0 type tools and how you might make use of those in the classroom. And then finally, under the category Other Collaborative Presentations, they have things like teacher tech tips and inspiring YouTube videos. I've been using those just as a one-minute little discussion starter at the beginning of computer lab time. There's some amazing YouTube videos out there that you could take advantage of in a classroom setting. And if you're not into YouTube, there's lots of ways to tone it down with, like, QuietTube, I think, is
mm-hmm.
one that'll get rid of all the garbage around it for classroom use. So I found like a treasure chest here, and I just wanted to share it with everybody. Hopefully you can find some ideas to inspire you at the Ideas to Inspire website.
Very good. My pick is a service that we've talked about before and that many congregations have already, onelicense.net. For those of you that aren't aware, it's a service that allows you to produce or reproduce copyrighted songs, for the most part, in the worship context. It's a service that's based on your average weekly attendance, so it's an annual license. So, for instance, if you have an average weekly attendance of 500 people, That's going to cost you $225 a year. Very reasonable. Then you do some reporting that says what pieces you used. And obviously it only covers what they cover, but they cover most of the major publishers. And so it's a great deal. But recently, and I think with good reason, they added an option that is called their podcasting option. So in essence, what that covers is the reuse or recording of a worship service or wherever it is you're using these copyrighted materials, and then allows you to audio or video podcast the content, and that too would be covered. And I think at a fairly reasonable price. So the scenario offered earlier, 500 average weekly attendance, would be the $225 for the OneLicense.net base license, and then another $113, so it's about 50% of the cost, again, to cover any audio or video podcasting you want to do of that particular service. Now, there are some limitations. First of all, it covers anything that that your OneLicense.net covers. It doesn't cover anything else, but there are some restrictions. Let me see if I can find this here.
Martin, I just want to clarify while you're looking for that. When you talk about podcasting, basically you're talking about recording the content and making it available via the internet. So distributing an archived version of the worship service so that anyone could download it and listen to it at a time shifted at any time. And so I think that's the big deal here, is that we've said in the past, for staying within the legalities of copyright, you could broadcast your service live as if someone were in worship with you at that time. But the recording of it and the redistribution of it, it was the big rub.
Yep. And that's what this license covers. Go ahead, Gail.
Is it video and audio?
Video and audio, yes. Which is cool. There are some restrictions, though. You can only publish the content for a year. So after a year is up, you have to remove that content. And it can only be downloaded 3 times your average attendance. So any one piece of content, let's say you have 500 average attendance, it can only be downloaded 1,500 times, so you have to have a way of knowing how many downloads took place, you know, for that piece of content. So those are the two big things you have to watch out for. But other than that, it really sounds like something that a lot of our congregations could make good use of. A lot of our congregations have been doing some audio and video podcasting, but it's been mostly of the sermon, mostly for copyright reasons. And this overcomes that barrier if you wanted to include, you know, a hymn or something else along those lines. Now, I don't know what the implications are for liturgy. We've talked with the good folks at MPH in the past, so if you're using Christian worship, it may be worth a phone call into them to say, hey, can we do this? I'm not sure if all that is covered under OneLicense.net. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I think they're more than willing to grant that permission for this purpose. So I think this is a great service, and I think we're going to be seeing more of these as well. But they got a long, long list of publishers, so it's chances are good that you're going to be covered with the stuff that you've got in your service folder.
And what's Martin, nice is many of our congregations are using OneLicense.net already, so
right.
This is just
a little bolt-on
add-on that
exactly.
Keeps you covered for podcasting.
Yep, and you should be covered, yes. Gail,
and just to repeat once more, Martin, it's an add-on, but the cost?
Is 50% of your license, of your regular OneLicense.net license,
okay.
So it depends on average attendance.
Okay, so the add-on is 50%?
Right,
And we have a link to include in our show notes with all that pricing.
Yep. Yeah, they make it pretty easy, and I think that was one of their goals, is to, you know, to make this dumb simple. Now, you have to report on that, on those as well, just like you have to report on what you're using in your worship service, but small price to pay.
Well, thank you for that pick. That's
sure.
Great.
Good. Hopefully that's of use. We want to remind everybody that this is the last week to enter our big 100th show contest. October 7th, we'll be doing our 100th show, and our focus is on you. We're dedicating the show to our listeners, and we would love for you to share your story with us about those things that you've plucked from the treasure chest that is the Wells Tech podcast, hopefully for you, and tell us what you've used, what's made a difference. This show is really about trying to figure out how to use technology in ministry, and our listeners are the ones in ministry, so it makes sense for you to share with us what you're doing. So you have until, did we say Friday midnight, Sally? Was that the deadline?
That's right, October 2nd. And if we get your entry by then, we'll make sure and include it in the show, and we'll also enter you in a drawing for an aluminum SIG water bottle, really nice gear that you want to add to your Wells Tech collection of goodies. So branded with the Wells Tech logo, you'll want to have the SIG water bottle.
Yep. And the way to get a hold of us is go to our website, wellstech.wells.net. And there's a Contact Us button. You see all the ways that you can contact us through voicemail, through email, wellstech@wells.net, through Twitter, Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. We watch all those channels for your good stuff.
I actually had someone contact me and ask a real technical question about our contest.
Yes.
How long of a voicemail can they leave? Okay. And, you know, I don't know the answer to that. Does our voicemail box turn people off after a certain amount of time?
I guess we might find out. I don't know.
Yeah. If you have a long audio content that you want to send us, feel free to record it and email us an MP3 file, and we can play it that way as well.
That's right.
I'm a pretty long talker, and I've never been cut off.
Okay.
All right.
There's the test.
Okay. Speaking of feedback, let's go to our community feedback section, Sally.
Yeah, I just wanted to have a bit of follow-up on the show from last week. We talked about intranets, which was a great topic for churches that are kind of ready to have a member-focused website that's perhaps a little bit more private.
Mm-hmm.
We've actually added a page on our Wells Tech Wiki, just kind of summarizing the notes from our show last week, providing some links to our sample intranet sites, that kind of thing. But we'd love to beef up that page by having you add your own experience. So maybe you're using Member Connect or Church Community Builder or some other intranet solution. Please head out to our Wells Tech Wiki intranet page and add your experience. Tell us what you like, what you don't like, what's being adopted well in your congregation, that kind of thing. And also stay in contact with our listserv, because there is an ongoing Wells Tech listserv discussion around this topic as well. And we'll include a link to that in our show notes.
Beautiful.
Yep. And then other feedback was via Twitter. Our two of our favorite Twitterers, Jason Schmidt and Miss Gail Patretz, had some tweets this week. Jason shared with us a link to Woofer, which is for those of us that can't fit our thoughts in 140 characters or less. Woofer, instead of tweeting, you're woofing. You have 1,400 characters. So they call it macro blogging instead of microblogging. So check that out if you're long-winded. That might be a solution for you. And he also made a comment in response to Gail, who was tweeting about Mina. Mina is online audio editing, similar to GarageBand on the Mac. And Jason said, yes, Aviary, the makers of Mina, have tweaked up their image editing software called Phoenix as well. So quite the package of products that this site Aviary is now offering. So if you haven't checked it out yet, Jason and Gail recommend it highly.
Very good. Keep the feedback coming. And I'm really looking forward to the show next week when we have a number of entries already. We could still use more, but all kinds of neat things that we're hearing about uses of the stuff that we talk about here, which is kind of gratifying.
Right, and interesting for us, I think you'll all hear this next week, that people are coming in from a lot of different angles. So hopefully the show is speaking to you in some way or another in the personal or public ministry that you're trying to carry out.
Gail, as always, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate the time you take and your busy schedule.
My pleasure.
Sally, you as well. And we will talk to everybody next week. Let's close with the beautiful keyboarding skills of Don Gelhar. Nearer My God to Me to Thee is what she will be playing from her album Inspirations. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. We love to have you back next week, and have a great week between now and then.